I'm Craig, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Craig.
We love you, Craig. Lots and lots and lots. And all lunches.
Ah! Awesome. Where were you guys when I got sober? So my sobriety date is February 14th, 1990. I got sober in a little town called Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. I was in college, and for some reason, I had a moment of clarity, and somehow figured out to pick up the phone and call the AA hotline, and you know, I'll get to that later. My home group is the Thursday Night Men's Group in Park City. It's at 7 p.m., and if you're of that persuasion, please come up and join us some Thursday night. We'd love to have you. So like I said, I was born in Pennsylvania. I was born in a little, born in a place called Reading, and I come from as far back as I can see on my father's side of the family. Alcoholism, addiction was part of the deal. So, you know, I have a belief, and this is my stuff, I have a belief that this addiction thing has some genetics for me. And I was predisposed to go down this road with addiction, so to speak. You know, but I had a pretty interesting, by the way, my mother is here. That's Ethel.
Hi, Ethel.
And my mom is here visiting myself and my new wife and our new baby. Yay. And the baby just woke up, so she could not make the trip. She was crying. As a young kid, there was a lot of that going on in my household. You know, I don't know what kind of wounds I got or what I picked up as a 3-year-old, but I have a belief that some of that stuff formed who I am today. And that's just part of my journey. My parents got divorced when I was 3, and my mom was left to raise me and my brother and my father got to run wild with his disease, and I got to be a part of that. You know, as probably a 6 or a 7 or an 8-year-old. So my dad to me was like, he was everything, because he only got to see me once in a while on weekends. And it wasn't every weekend because he was too busy drinking. So when he did get to see me, I was the kind of I was his baby. My brother was a lot older than me. So I was kind of the focus of my dad's eye. And what we would do is we would go to the bar. You know, that's what my dad did with me. He took me to the club and gave me quarters to play the pinball machine and run around with a couple of other kids that were at the club. And that was fun. I mean, you know, as a kid, that was fun. I got to play unlimited pinball and the I don't know if you guys know what the punch games are that he played, but you know, that's how I grew up, going to the dirt track races on Fridays and Saturdays. And how cool was it that my dad got so drunk that I got to drive the car home, you know? So that's kind of where I was as a preteen kid. That's what I was exposed to. Discipline at home from my mom, and my dad just, you know, man, it was fun, right? I got to drive a car, go play pinball. I mean, just cool stuff. So when I was about 12, I was with my father, and I think my dad at that time thought it was a good idea for me to have some beer. And I'll never forget my first experience drinking was, I was coming back from He had a like a camping spot or a boat on the Chesapeake Bay, and we would go down there. And I had a couple. I had a stepbrother and two stepsisters and a stepmom, and we were driving back. And they used to make these little tiny. I don't even know if they make them anymore, but these little tiny bottles of beer. They're like 6 or 7 ounces, kid sized. Right? At least that's what my dad thought. So for some reason, I was allowed to drink these kid-sized bottles of beer. And that first time, I mean, y'all know what I'm talking about. That first time, man, it was it. It's what I was meant to do, right? It just changed everything. And weekends or times with my father from that point on were about me being able to drink and party with my dad. So from about the age, you know, probably not so much at 12, but by the time I was 14 or 15, it was full on with my pop. You know, that's what we did. We drank. And we had fun. At least that's what it was then. And then, you know, so I have two different, I had that experience with my father, and I have another experience with my mother and my stepfather, who I'm with full time. And there's none of that shit going on in that house, right? You know, that's just not allowed. And so I sneak it because, you know, that's what I do. I'm an addict. I can hide, I can lie, I can cheat, I can steal, I can fool anybody. I can fool anybody. And I fooled them. And, you know, I started smoking pot and my stepfather had health issues, so there was all kinds of drugs in the house, pills. I'd steal his pills. Smoking pot before school all the time, smoking pot at school, drinking before school. Just getting it done, getting my addiction on, so to speak, right? And, you know, I was able to pretty much do that weekends. And I don't know if y'all remember that TV show called The A-Team. But I think it was on Monday nights or Tuesday nights. And we used to have A-Team night at my buddy's house. And we'd go over there and pull bongs and drink beer and watch The A-Team. And that's what we did on Monday or Tuesday nights, school night. I'd come home and just kind of walked straight down for my room, and they never knew. At least if they did, they didn't say anything. Sorry, Mom. you know, I was so good at my addiction and my use is that I set up a study room in my house, and my study room was in the mechanical room, and in the mechanical room was the furnace. And I had a desk in front of the furnace, and whenever the heat would turn on, you know, I would smoke up and blow it into the furnace, and that's what I did at home, right? I didn't get in too much trouble as a young drinker. I did some stupid stuff, but I didn't get caught. Drinking and driving was different then than it is today. I remember getting pulled over once. I was driving home with my head out the window, and I got pulled over, and I don't know how I got to keep driving home, but I got to keep driving home. Maybe he told me to put my head back in the window. I don't know, but it was very different then than where I lived, maybe, than it is today. But I never was arrested for that stuff. I never got caught. That's not to say I didn't do things that I should have gotten arrested for. Time to go to school, and my stepfather pulls me aside and basically says, "You're 18 now. You graduated, you're on your own, you can do what you want." And he was really my father because my dad was my party buddy. You know, that just gave me more license to go off to the races. I go to college and my nickname became Keg. and there was a keg. My name's Craig. They called me Keg. There was a keg that I found every Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I mean, it was full on in college. I had my class schedule arranged so I didn't have to go. And really, I mean, that's what it was about. It was about the party, you know, full on. I don't know how I managed to stay in college, but my freshman year of college, I was pretty much blacked out every night. I don't remember what I did, and I didn't think I had a problem. I didn't know that alcohol and drugs was a problem yet, right? It was just fun. And this blacking out thing, I didn't really understand, but I didn't like it because I would hear stories about some of the stuff I did the night before, you know, and I wasn't comfortable with it. It kind of scared me. What did I do? I drank more and I used more, right? That's what I did. And eventually, for some reason, I stopped blacking out. And I don't know why that is for this alcoholic, but it just stopped. And I don't know if it was because I was doing a combination of the right drugs, I mean, you know, or what, but I just stopped blacking out and I was able to stay pretty coherent on my runs, which was we all did. That's why we're here. So I was a skier and I was addicted to skiing and I still am. I'm addicted to things that make me feel good. Sliding is one of them. Gravity is another. I mean, I just love that kind of stuff that makes me feel good. Alcohol and drugs made me feel good. So anything today I find that makes me feel good, I usually have to watch my behavior around it because I can do it like a lot. So, I am an addict through and through. But anyway, skiing was a big part of my life, and I had my best friend was a skier, and Patrick Barry and I were like brothers. He was my best friend. We did everything together. We would stay up and do acid, you know, we would stay for 3 days on LSD. We went to dead shows together. I mean, we did everything together. We lived together, we were roommates, we skied together. I had a job in Killington, Vermont. He didn't get the job, he drove me up there, which is a 6-hour drive, so I could ski and spend a month there drinking and skiing. And Patrick and I made big plans. The plans we made were to move out west when we were both done with college. And Patrick finished a year before me. I was on the 6-year plan, he was on the 5-year plan. And unfortunately, at the young, beautiful age of 21, I lost my best friend. He took a bunch of LSD and decided that the view would be better from on top of a railroad tower along the railroad tracks. And the electricity jumped and killed him. And so my life changed. And at the time, I was drinking a lot. I was drinking constantly. I was selling dope. I was the president of my fraternity, which was a drug and drinking fraternity at my college. And when Pat died, I was failing all my classes. And it was the perfect excuse for me to go to the dean and say, I need out. And they let me out. And I drove to Killington, Vermont, because I needed to go skiing, because that's what Patrick and I did. And there was no snow, it was freaking raining. And I had an ounce of dope, and I stopped at the Mending Country store, looked at a road atlas, and I decided that it was time for me to move out west and go to Colorado. And I called my mom and I called her and I said, Mom, I'm driving to Colorado and they begged me to come home And I said, I'm going to Colorado. I need to go skiing. And I smoked my way and drank my way across the country. There's this little town called Lyman on the Front Range of Colorado. It's where you go north or south. So you go to the Northern Rockies or the Southern Rockies, Telluride or Summit County. And I think I got beat up in Lyman, Colorado. I remember going to a bar. And I was in a brownout. Y'all know what a brownout is. And I think I got beat up. And I think I got beat up quite a lot in my drinking, because I would say stupid shit and do stupid things. Anyway, I decided to go north. And I stopped at a ski shop. I said, hey, if you had a place to go and you had a year off, where would you go? And he told me to go to Breckenridge. And I drove to Breckenridge, and I discovered this bar called the Gold Pan Bar. And the first night there, I got in a blackout, crashed my car, and somehow did not get arrested. I don't know how I didn't, but I didn't. And I lived in a motel. And in Colorado, they had 3.2 beer that they sell at the grocery stores, but I didn't know that. All I thought was like, damn, I can drink a lot of beer in Colorado. Until about 2 weeks in, somebody told me that it's 3.2 beer and you need to buy your beer at the liquor store. I drank all the time in Colorado. I got connected in Colorado. Like, I knew the bars to go to because I knew the bartender. I knew how to get my hands on what I needed in other areas of my usage. I worked at a place called the Vista House on top of the mountain, so I got to eat breakfast for free. And when I bussed tables, I would eat leftovers. I would eat people's food before I threw it away. I had a friend, Brian, who I used to ski with, and Brian used to pick me up, and he told me his liver hurt, and I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. And in Colorado in 1989 is when I thought maybe I might have a problem with drinking and drugging. I didn't want to be like my father, and I felt like I was drinking like my father, and that was every night. And I told myself, I was in a townhome with some other people at that time, and I told myself, you know, if I can just stop drinking for like a week, I'm cool. Everything will be okay. And I smoked pot, but I didn't think that was a problem. I just thought it was drinking, which, you know, was a big deal for me. And the next day I skied, and I was awfully thirsty, right? And I told myself, Just go home. Don't stop at City Market, which is where the liquor store was. Just go home. And as I'm driving down the road, I'm getting closer to my house, I tell myself, just go in the door and go down the hallway, because I lived in the basement. Go down the hallway and grab some tap water. And the light at the top of the steps was beautiful. And I walked up the steps, and I told myself, just grab some tap water out of the sink. And I opened the refrigerator, and I told myself, reach past the one bottle of beer and grab the iced tea. And I grabbed the beer, and I popped the top, and I drank it, and I went back to the liquor store and continued my journey. I partied hard in Colorado. I passed out one night outside, and for some reason, something woke me up, and I stumbled home. It was a lot of fun to be had, but there was also a lot of pain in Colorado. I decided I needed to go back home and finish school. I was in love with a woman who I thought I was going to marry, and I wind up back in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. And I remember sitting down with her at dinner one night and saying, "Honey, I think I might have a problem with alcohol and drugs." And she said, "No. You don't have a problem. You just need to slow down a little bit." Okay, I can do that. So we moved in together, and she actually got to see how bad my problem with alcohol and drugs really was. I mean, I was a daily drinker. I drank vodka. In Colorado, I had a friend. I was a beer drinker. Beer, pot, LSD, that's what I did. I'm a deadhead. I was into the dead. And I went to Jackson Hole, and I had a friend from the East Coast visit me in Jackson. And he said, "Craig, you drink a lot of beer." He's like, "Let me buy you a drink." I'm like, "Really? Cool. Somebody's going to buy me a drink." So he comes back with this tumbler of vodka with a little bit of 7-Up or something and a sprig of lime. He says, "Here you go." And that was the first time I really, like my alcoholic mind got it, right? Like, I don't have to drink a whole case and a half of beer. I can just drink these tumblers of vodka. So I forget his name, but I'm really grateful that he did that to me, because it helped me to progress my disease at that age. It saved me money, too. Yeah, so vodka became my drink, and so now there were empty half gallons of vodka at the house, and Linda somehow got me to say that I was an alcoholic. Somehow she got me to what a blessing this woman was in my life. I'm 22 years old. And somehow she gets me to say out loud that I'm an alcoholic. I think she was getting coached, but I'm really grateful that she was, because she got me to say it out loud. And I told her I'd quit. I'm gonna quit. And I did. So it was like September, October. I stopped. I just stopped drinking. And I was smoking pot, but I wasn't drinking. And y'all can relate to that. And about 30 days in, she went away. Like she flew out of the state to see a friend, right? She's gone for like 7 or 8 days. Game on. And as soon as she was out the door, I was with my buddies. I'm still in college. I'm with my buddies, and I'm off to the races. I'm putting everything in me that I can. I did some horrible things that week. Horrible things. And I actually had thoughts that I hope the plane crashes on the way home so I don't have to face what I've done. And it's someone who I loved. And she came home, and I had to raise my hand because the stories were all over the place. And that's when I went to AA for the first time. I said, "Honey, I'm going to go to AA." That's when I made the phone call, right? "I'm going to go to AA, and I'm going to ride my bike to the meeting." And she would not let me ride my bike to the meeting. She insisted on driving me because my favorite bar was on the way to the meeting. So she insisted on driving me. And she dropped me off at this church in my college town, and it was this old, beautiful stone church. I don't know what denomination it was, but there was a light on. You all know the light by the door, you know, where the steps go downstairs. There was a light on. That's where the meeting was. You know, I didn't go to that door. I went to every other door on the church, and they were all locked. I said, "Honey, all the doors are locked. The meeting must not, I must have made a mistake. The meeting must not be here." And here comes this man walking down the street, Ed M. And he walks right up to me. He says, "Are you looking for a meeting?" And she's there. I said, "Yes, I'm looking for a meeting." He says, I got this. And he took me into the meeting, my first AA meeting. And I don't remember a lot in that AA meeting, except I cried. And I felt like I finally was at home. And he took me home that night and kidnapped me for an hour and told me about the Serenity Prayer and gave me a book and a 12 and 12, do this, do that, read this, read that, call me, but that. So I went for 30 days. I got a different sponsor, Bob, because I knew Bob from my partying days. And he told me to do a 30 and 30 or 90 and 90 or whatever. And I started smoking a little pot, right? Because that was okay. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had some guilt going on about it. Not too much, but I had some guilt. And I had a feeling that it might not be a good thing to be doing this deal and doing that, but, you know, in 1990 in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, it was pretty old school AA. They didn't talk about drugs, right? It was alcohol. And, you know, but I knew the difference. And, you know, Bob called me up and said, hey, can you get me some pot? And my sponsor, right? And I'm like, oh, cool. I guess it's okay to smoke pot. So I remember I was sitting in this meeting 90 days in, and I was sitting on a shelf just like that one where the food is, because they had a kitchen there too, and there's a couple of us young people sitting there. We were all, you know, we're all in college, and I looked out over these old people, guys my age and older. It was a smoking meeting, so there was cigarette smoke everywhere. I'm looking at these people, I'm like, these guys are ruining my, I'm gonna swear, these guys are ruining my fucking life, right? They don't know what the fuck they're talking about. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. This is a bunch of crap. I got a lot of fun to have out there yet. These guys are screwing it up for me. And I left, that switch went off. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but the switch went off in my head where you all were wrong and I was right. And I left that meeting, and I went home to the woman who I loved, who I was going to marry, I thought, and I told her, you're ruining my dreams. Right? I told this poor woman, you're ruining my dreams. I'm not going to get to do A, B, C, D, and E because of you. And I left her. I walked out, grabbed my skis, some clothes, threw them in my Volkswagen van, and headed to the mountain and saw my friends there and decided it was game on. And 3 days later, I can't get enough alcohol and drugs in me to make it go away. And what I mean by making it go away is I can't make the pain go away and I can't have fun. I just can't get to that spot. And I was lying in bed in a new house with my drinking friends who were supporting me in my new decision. And I wanted to kill myself because I just couldn't get there. I wanted it all to end. And I had seen a therapist for a while, and I called my mom and my stepfather the next morning, and they helped to get me into an outpatient program. And that's what I did. I went into an outpatient program, and I went every night for probably 30 days. I was able to stay in school, and I went back to AA and started to actually do what you all told me to do. And what you all told me to do was to get a sponsor, right? Check, I got a sponsor. You all told me to go to 90 and 90. Well, I was doing that. I was going to one or two meetings a day. And you all told me to be of service. And my sponsor helped me get a service commitment, and that was making coffee and emptying ashtrays. And that's what I did. You know, and I was able to come every day. I was able to do this deal. And for some reason, I didn't pick up a drink. I was given the power of choice back, and I was able to choose between drinking or not drinking, or using and not using. And you know what? I started to put days together, and I started to put time together. And next thing you know, I'm picking up a 3-month chip. And I call my, you know, I'm supposed to call my sponsor every night. I don't do that, right? I'm 23 years old. That's just not what I do. I don't recommend it, but I didn't do that. And Jim, what am I supposed to do? I got 3 months. He's like, well, why don't you do another 90-90? All right, I can do that. It worked, right? I didn't know it worked, but like it worked. So I committed to him to do another 90-90. And next thing you know, I have 6 months. And I call him, because I don't call him every day. Because he keeps telling me I have to do these things called the 12 steps, right? Like I can do 1, 2, 3, no problem. 12. Right? Like I can do that. And that was my journey for a while in here. But I kept coming here, and I kept doing that. And I called him, and I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And he says, want to do another 90-90. And lo and behold, I did that, and then I had 9 months. And when I had 9 months, I called him again. And he said, do another 90-90. And I did. And then I had a year. And this program is a miracle. Because I was living in my college town, and at one time I was the president of my fraternity, and I had lots of guys around me that wanted to party, and somehow I managed to stay sober. Somehow I managed to find other young people that were my age that I could hang out with and do things with that didn't involve drugs and alcohol. And that's what I did. And the miracle started to happen for me. He started to really badger me about doing the steps, and especially this thing called the fourth step. And I didn't have a job, right? I had a grant, they have a Pell Grant to go to school. I was living rent free in another recovery guy's at another guy's house. So he told me to get a job. And I did, and I got a job, and I got my first job in recovery, and it was stocking shelves at a supermarket. I made minimum wage, and minimum wage at that time was $3.35, so I was making bank, right? But what it taught me at that time was that I had to work, right? Like I didn't get a free pass. And I didn't stay at that job a long time, but I stayed at that job long enough to actually learn that piece, you know, that I got it, that I need to show up, and I need to do my job and do it well and do the deal. And that was part of what he was teaching me to do. And it came time for me, I wanted to move back out west, because that's what I'm a skier, right? That was my love, that's my passion. I'm like, Jim, I want to move back out west. He's like, you can't move back out west until you do your fourth and your fifth step. And then he also threw in this thing like, you need to be here a year. No changes for a year. So I was still in my first year of recovery. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do? And he's like, why don't you pray about it? So I prayed about it to whatever. And these men in my town approached, found me, and they said, hey, we're going to start a ski shop, and we would like you to help us open it and manage it. We hear that you're a skier and you lived out west. And I'm like, really? They're like, yeah. I'm like, I'll take the job. We want you to sign a year contract. So there's God working in my life. I do my fourth step. I do my fifth step. I make an attempt at 6 and 7. I start to ride out 8. And I'm ready to move out west. And I'm like, what do I do? He's like, pray about it. So I start praying about it. And my job that I had as a perk, they sent me to Park City because they wanted me to sign another contract for a year. And I'm praying, like, where do I go? And they sent me to Park City on a free trip for 3 days to go skiing. And I go to AA because that's what I do when I get to Park City. I go to AA and I meet some people. And I meet some girls in the hot tub. And the one girl, it was like, well, you can stay with me when you move out here. So I go home, I quit my job, and I start a painting business to make money. I make enough money. I load up my van with everything I own, and I drive across the country, and I land in Park City, Utah. And the first thing I do when I get to Park City is I go to a meeting, and I get my ass to meetings, and I go every day to a meeting. And so I'm probably 18 months to 2 years sober, and I'm skiing all the time. I'm tuning skis and living off the free samples at Albertsons. I'm not doing the program, but I'm doing the fellowship, if y'all know what I mean. I'm going to meetings, but I'm not really plugged in. I got a sponsor, but I go on tour with the Dead for a while. I do a rock climbing trip around the West Coast. You know, I'm doing a lot of things as a young man that I always talked about when I was drinking and using, and I couldn't do because I was too busy drinking and using. And when I got sober and I started to walk through my fears, I actually had enough courage to do the things that I talked about doing, and one of them was going on tour. I don't know if you all know what that is. Another one was just driving around, living in my van, rock climbing. So I did a lot of that stuff that I talked about. But what I found out 7 years into this deal is that I was one unhappy dude. I mean, I used to sit in the meetings in Park City. I had this big hippie sweater. I had long hair. I had a Volta, you know, I was skiing every day. I used to sit and I used to judge all of you, you know? I judged all of you. You guys, you know, you had the fat house, you had the hot wife, you had money in your pocket, but I was skiing every day, right? You know, you guys aren't happy, I'm happy. And 7 years in, I moved to Salt Lake. I don't know if they still have the young people's meeting down on the church downtown. What's that? I used to go to that meeting with a guy named Stevie B, a friend of mine. But I wasn't going to a lot of meetings. I was living in Salt Lake, skiing at Alta. And I got to a point where I'm like, if this is all that there is in my life, I might as well drink and drug, because I can ski every day and use drugs and drink. This is a no-brainer. And I finally got to a place where it was so bad inside that I finally asked a man to take me through the steps. And I did it. I did it with everything I had. I jumped in with both feet. I did step one, like he told me to. I did step two, three, four. I did them all, like he told me to. He read the book with me. I learned about the book. Because it's that you know, this program is only about that thick, right? It's only 164 pages long. And my life changed. Man, it changed. When I did the steps, everything changed for me. I started to live life on purpose. I started to live life in mission. I started to really look at me and how I thought I was broken and what I needed to do to fix those parts of me that those wounds, and that all was because of four, you know, step four, five, six, seven, really getting to look at myself and how I walked through my life. And you know, I'm a different man today than I was when I walked in here at the age of 23. And I'm a different man today at the age of 48 than I was when I first did the steps at the age of 32, 31. I'm not that same person, right? Today I work with others. I love reading the book with other men. I love reading the page by page and going through the book. And every time I read the book, something new happens for me. It just reads different. You know, and I know a lot of y'all know this, but when I'm blessed enough to be asked to read the book with somebody, you know, I get the gift. I'm the one who gets the gift. Hopefully they stay sober and they do the deal, but I get the gift. And the gift for me today is I get to keep doing this deal. I get to keep coming here and sitting in a chair. I get to keep sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And I keep getting to listen to what you all tell me and what your experience and your strength and your hope is. The beautiful thing about AA for me is that when I'm plugged in, there's nothing in my life that I've gone through that I haven't been able to find another man in AA that walked through it with dignity and grace, and he can teach me. I didn't have that before I came in here. I didn't have that available to me. And today I do. I have, and my work is with men. I'm a strong believer that the men work with the men and the women work with the women. I like men's meetings, and I like meetings that are on purpose. And what I mean by meetings that are on purpose are meetings that are solution based, that are in the book, in the 12 and 12, because I get to stay in the solution. Because when I first came to AA in Park City, there wasn't a lot of that going on. They were talking about their Audis and their Mercedes and their lost dogs, and you know, it's different now. But it wasn't like that then, and I love solution-based meetings because we get to stay on task, right? I get to hear the solution. And for me, men's meetings are about, I know when I was single and I was going to mixed meetings, a lot of times I was looking at the pretty girl thinking, what can I say to impress her, you know? So if I'm thinking that, I know I'm not the only one in the room thinking that. So, you know, that's just me. That's my stuff. I feel like there's a lot more honesty going on in a solution-based meeting and a single-gender meeting, I guess is what you would call that. You know, and because of doing the steps and doing the deal, right, I have a beautiful life today. Beautiful life. I have my own business. I was a carpenter for years, and I used to be so hung up on, I went to college. Why am I a carpenter, man? Why do I got to do this shit? And I had a friend tell me, you know, Jesus was a carpenter. I'm like, right? Now, that's not my faith, right? But I got it. I'm like, well, if Jesus could be a carpenter, why can't I? You know? So I jumped into it with both feet. And today, you know, today I'm a home builder. I have a successful business. I never thought that I would be married, and I held on and held out until I was healthy enough to actually be in a loving and giving relationship where I could be of service to my wife or my partner, and she came along. She showed up, and I got married a year ago. And I have a beautiful little baby, Cassidy Rose. Cassidy is one of my favorite Grateful Dead songs. And Rose is a symbol of the Grateful Dead. And I didn't come up with the name. My wife did. And she said, what do you think of Cassidy Rose? I'm like, that's a great name. And she had no idea. So, I mean, when I let go and I don't get in the way, when I put my agenda down, and I let the universe, which I call God, because I don't know what else to call it, when I give up and I let go and I just do the next thing, life is amazing. It just keeps getting better. And it's not that it's not hard, because it gets really hard sometimes and there's a lot of bullshit. But if I let go of my expectations and my agenda, it usually turns out okay. I usually get something better than I thought that I thought I wanted. And I know y'all heard this before, but if I would have sat down when I was 23 years old and I walked through the doors of AA, if I would have sat down and wrote down what I wanted, what I thought my life needed to look like, I would have sold myself so fucking short. Because it's a whole different deal today than it was 25 years ago. Whole different deal. I'm happy, I'm joyous, and I'm free. Something I never even knew what that meant, I get to live that today. And it's all because of you. Because you guys keep showing me how to do the deal. And that's all I got. Thank you.